Betty from Hastings shares with you now. Betty.
My name is Betty, and I'm an alcoholic. You can hear me. Yeah. This aisle to AA, this, you know, I've never stood in a place like this before. I've never stood before, I think this thing's called a lesson. And Ginger said to me, this is all too professional, that life, it's too professional. And I said, never mind, we'll take care of that. And I was thinking, while Ginger was talking, I am nervous, and I shouldn't be, because I have learned in this program to track back what it is I really feel. And the nervousness is ego. The nervousness is vanity. The nervousness is pride. I want to do a good job. I want you to think that I have got good sobriety, you know, that I'm better than I am. And that's not what I prayed for, you know. What I'd like is that if there's somebody here suffering as I did, if there's somebody at yet one more convention having had a drink yesterday or the day before, somebody who's been around a long time, somebody like me who's sort of becoming an old timer in the fellowship and still drinking, from the book, do not be discouraged. If there's something that you need to hear, let me say it. As Ginger said, let me leave a little room for God. This I owe to AA. This, that you see. And I was thinking about it. The good, strong, healthy head of hair. I lost my hair when I was drinking, and I wore wigs, and I didn't encourage the growth of my hair. And I couldn't wear wigs going to work, and I had to wear a hat at work. So I'd get up early in the morning to wash my hair to find something to pin the hat on. I owe to AA the fact that I can hold my neck straight, that there isn't excruciating neurotic pain on one side. I owe to AA the fact that my gullet isn't inflamed from drink and drugs, so that I have pins and needles and numbness and in my fingers and hands and pains down the sides of my arms. I owe to AA the fact that in spite of my nervousness, I have at the moment, if a little fast, a very steady heartbeat. I wasn't like that. I was given much to palpitation. I owe to AA the fact that I can eat what I like within reason. The fact that we were the last in the canteen. There was one rather sorry looking supper left. I shared it with one other. It went down well and was sustaining, and I haven't got a stomachache, and I don't feel any nausea. I owe to AA the fact that I have a relatively trim waist. I had a liver out here. I couldn't wear a belt or tights or a skirt. I wore tent like garments because the pain, when anything touched my engorged and swollen liver, was very bad. I owe to AA the fact that when I go to bed, I don't have to pack up an old pair of pants which I had to wear because I was unsure of the action of my bowels and bladder. I owe to AA the fact that my ankles don't swell so much, the fact that I can wear nice shoes with heels, high heels as it happens. Because I couldn't wear heels of any kind, not even one inch. I shuffled along in moccasins with no heels because I was afraid that I'd fall off the smallest heel. I got that bad with drinking. I didn't drink for that long, you know, and I did most of my drinking as a member of this fellowship. I joined Alcoholics Anonymous because 18 months following getting into drinking, I was an undrinker and a non-smoker by choice. My life became unmanageable and the ground fell away from under me. When I was 34, and a year and a half following getting into the drink, I was in a mental hospital, diagnosed an alcoholic, and out there I had a golden opportunity. And when I look back today, I know that my life from the beginning was studded with golden opportunities. I wasn't able to take advantage of them. I took to all of them energy, intelligence, hope, ambition, drive, and alcoholism. Even before I drank, I took this high potentiality to resentment, intolerance, self-pity and guilt. And in a while, my concentration was poor, and I became angrier, and eventually enraged and explosive and aggressive and hostile. That's what I took to my drinking. And the drinking magnified every bit of that, so that any virtue I had disappeared, and all the vicious side of my nature went into the ascendancy. And in that mental hospital, the psychiatrist who treated me was an alcoholic who had recovered through exposure to Alcoholics Anonymous. So the prescription for me was membership of this fellowship. And I didn't like that because I expected specialists, consultants in hospital to give you a date for the operation or a prescription for the tablets. And I did know a little bit about the nature of Alcoholics Anonymous because I was reasonably well read. And I knew I didn't want to join. It wasn't so much that it was Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a sense of distance and disassociation from any idea that I could belong or that Alcoholics Anonymous could have anything to offer me. But I wasn't a joiner of things anyway. I didn't belong to any pubs or professional organizations or trade unions or anything. I saw myself as a very independent person who could do her own negotiating, and I didn't want to join anything. I didn't want to join Alcoholics Anonymous because in some way I knew it was free, and I wanted to pay my way. Brought up that way, my mother used to say, pay your way, don't be under a compliment to anyone. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, as I say, I think it was in late February, early March, 1965. And I had my most recent drink, this is an open meeting, on the 28th of January, 1979. So it took a long time. I didn't drink for the first 8 years. But I didn't do anything else because I never knew what I was doing there. I didn't want to be there. I didn't like it. I couldn't understand what they were talking about. They were mostly businessmen. There were three other women, and I guessed, and I later found out they were all old enough to be my mother. And I felt very far out of it. I used to whine. I'm the youngest here. And I'm the only Irish one. And all this. 6 months later, an Irishman, 6 years younger than myself, joined. So I had to find something else to moan about, and I did. I never stopped. I never, ever, ever was stuck. for a fault, you know, because I was a very thoroughgoing person when it came to criticizing, complaining, or condemning. I could, that was my strong suit. And I drank again, you know, as sure as the night, the day, because whatever they talked about, I didn't think it applied to me. I had no sense of identification in the conscious sense. But looking back now, I know that unconsciously this thing got at me from the beginning, because I could never sleep the night of a meeting. And so I was very casual about going to meetings. I came late, and I only lived 4 minutes away from the meeting. I had to make them understand I had better things to do, you know, that I was a big dealer, if you like. And I drank almost 8 years to the day. And when I drank, it was not because of any crisis. This is the thing I have found in myself. The man who was the founder member of the group I joined tried to really teach us, and it was teaching us in those days, because he was the only one with any sobriety. He tried to teach us basic things like, don't get drunk at Christmas, be very careful. Don't get drunk in the new year, because it's very hard to stay sober then. But never mind all that, you've got a good chance. Watch the middle of January, that's when you're likely to. And I found that to be true. I drank again and again and again and again in January, having got over the crisis. You know, whatever crisis, the crisis didn't drive me to drink, so to speak. I was fairly good in a crisis. It was the everydayness of life, the boredom. I used to think I'd been born bored. I had a very, very peculiar boredom threshold. Everything bored me. It made it easy, too, to complain and criticize and condemn. And when I drank again, I thought in my naivete, my ignorance, that all I had to do was stop the next day. It's a strange sickness that would make me forget that I'd been in a mental hospital. And the next day, I was banging on the off-license door at 20 to 8 in the morning, an hour and a half nearly before they opened, to get another bottle of whiskey. And I set in motion a cycle that lasted for me 6 years. In those 6 years, I had months and weeks without a drink. And always, you know, I know today what it was. People used to talk about the compulsion has been lifted from me. People came in, they got better, and they said the compulsion has been lifted from me. And in no deep way did I ever understand that. Because even throughout those 8 years, there was never a day I wasn't angry because I couldn't drink. Now, I liked being a teetotaler. I didn't want to drink. But I was furious that something was denied me. And I used to think, I know what it must have felt like in the Garden of Eden. You know, they had all this, because there was a lot about in my life, but what I wanted was what was really, it would seem to me, forbidden. I had no acceptance. So throughout the next 6 years, even though I would have months, weeks, or days without a drink, when the resentment was great enough, the self-pity was crippling enough, the intolerance was fine enough, and the guilt had got at me enough, I drank. Just gave way. It was no contest. And I know, because now I can look back, you see, I've had to find out these triggers. I've had to find out what it was. It took me back to the bottle time and time again. And really, I was living in an emotional and spiritual desert. You see, in those few months without a drink, I'd get myself looking okay again, clothes be right, and I'd talk good, you see. And people would say, you're fine, you know, and I would say, yes, I'm fine. And it was a cosmetic job. It never went anywhere. I read some stories in the book in this time, and there's one where the boss said to this man, "Pat, it seems as if you're doomed to roll in the gutter every 6 months for the rest of your life." And that's what it felt like, you know. I thought his name was Pat, he was probably Irish. "It's probably because I'm Irish I have to do this, you see, every 6 months for the rest of my life." Anyway, I can't chronicle the events that brought in on me a moment of truth, not in any sequential order, but I can say this. The one thing throughout those years that I did, I kept coming to meetings. And it was almost as if there was a recording angel somewhere who was marking me present, you see. What an accent. And when I chalked up enough days at meetings, the lights were turned on in the basement in which I lived. You know, I lived like a savage in a dark basement. And somehow I had the knowledge that there was a light switch somewhere, but I couldn't find it. And I went on beating myself in that lonely, dark, cold place all those years. Sometimes somebody in the groups would relax and they'd come in and say, you know, "Stitches here, plaster on the arm." These things didn't happen to me. I was black and blue from here to here, you see. So when I came to the meetings, I never said anything. I paid for my booze on check at the off-license, and I threw the bottles in the dustbin because I paid the rates, and that's what the dustbin was for. But in these rooms, in A rooms, I couldn't say I was drinking. I became a secret drinker in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, everybody else knew about it, but in these rooms, I couldn't say I've been drinking again. And I would say, when I seem to have chalked up enough time, this light went on in my understanding in the darkened basement in which I lived. And I understood a lot. It seemed, I wish I could tell you how it happened, but it seems to me that I was at a meeting and I was washing up so that I didn't have to talk to anybody. And someone came and took the towel from me and said, "There's a newcomer in that room, go in and talk to her." And I raged inside against this man. And on the way home, somebody was giving me a lift, and I continued this externalization of this resentment and rage and anger. What does he expect me? How dare he? What does he think I can say? What do I know about anything except how to get drunk? And this man said to me, "But you've only got to be willing to try." And that was the best thing I ever heard up to that moment. You see, because I thought immediately, but I didn't say it to him, "Nothing is that simple." And then I wondered, what is he talking about? What is it I've only got to be willing to try? I didn't know. And I couldn't say to him, because I couldn't ask anybody, "Tell me how, what do you mean?" Not nicely, not as a civil question. It had to be closed in anger, closed in resentment, tears and hostility. But the next night I went to a meeting, and I heard part of chapter 5 read out, and what I heard, over and over again, and they were always reading it out, but my reaction to the reading out of it was to block off. You know, I'd heard all that before. And I heard the title. It's called How It Works. And I thought, that's it. That's what I have failed to do. Now, all this came together in my head on the day when I most recently drank, on the 28th of January, 1979. Because I hadn't had a drink or a drug when I'm cross-addicted for 8 months before that. And I thought I was home free. I thought nothing would ever make me drink again. Yet an event, which for the moment, just let me pass on, occurred. The first thing I know today to become an experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, I couldn't share it, not with a sponsor, and I had one, couldn't be honest, trying to be impressive. I couldn't tell them at my home group, couldn't tell anybody. And I went out in a very deliberate way. I walked to the off-license, bought the booze, came home, went to bed to drink it, and hoped I'd stay there and not get up and start bothering my mother in Ireland, telling her it was her fault at 2 a.m, because that's the sort of thing I used to do when I drank. And when I got up the next day, I looked at myself in the mirror and I thought, I don't look too bad. I'm going to get away with this. Now that was the attitude of mind all those years on. I'm going to get away with it. At meetings for years they've been saying, do this for yourself. Because if you do it to fulfill somebody's expectations, the day may come when you can't fulfill them and you'll have to drink. And I didn't understand what that meant, even that day. But that day, however, at about 12:30, I was beset by a craving to drink so strong that there was no walking around it. I had to get drunk. And for the first time ever, I thought to myself, what the hell is it they're always saying I should do before I drink? You pick up the telephone before you pick up the drink. That's the thing. Now, then I did something which again was unusual for me. I picked up my little book with the names in it, and I turned sincerely to somebody who was likely to be in. I was always ringing people who weren't there. I came into meetings and I said, I rang you 6 times this week, you're never in. And I chose carefully, they were never in. So that this morning when I chose sincerely and carefully, just as I suspected, the person was in. And as I was dialing, I thought, no, don't do that. The thing to do is to pray, because that's what they'll tell, they always telling me to pray. Or pray first, then dial, then get drunk. And that was very sincere too, because I had no idea that this would work. They were always talking about, this is a miracle, the miracle of AA. To me, that was a hymn to sobriety that I didn't want to hear, you know. And so I went down on my knees in my own home with nobody there but me, and I blushed to the roots of my hair. And I asked God to take from me the compulsion to drink just for that day. I said that I would accept anything that came that day. I remember saying, send me anything, give me anything, test me in any way, anything but this crazy to drink. I can't go on like this. No life. Please, please, whatever you've been doing for the rest, I have some of it. And I will accept anything. And I remember this business of anything went like a refrain in my head. Seriously, I think it's somewhere in the literature, Bill also got into the habit of saying anything. And I didn't know that when I was going around saying it. I got up then, and I telephoned my friend, and I did a big grandstand thing. I didn't say I wanted to drink, and I got drunk yesterday, because that was too painful. I said I wanted to kill myself. I was in a pit of despair, and all those other dramatic things. That was the way I like to talk, you see. And I talked for 20 minutes to my friend, who was very kind, and then I put the phone down, and I picked up my paycheck. I went up, walked, put it in the bank, drew out the housekeeping money, went to the supermarket. Now, remember it was January, the airports were snowed up, there was frozen fog, there was frozen snow on the ground, and at 2:30, I was walking along the high street, smiling, and I seemed to remember that the sun was shining. I'm so sure the sun was shining, but when I looked back, it was a very funny thing to be happening in weather like that, if you see what I mean. And I have never, ever wanted to drink since that day. I saw right away where I'd been going wrong. The whole thing hit me, you see. That day I saw the unmanageability of my own life, and that's what crippled me. I knew about my alcoholism. I knew I was an alcoholic. I knew I must never drink, but I couldn't stop. I couldn't avoid it. But I didn't know about the unmanageability of my life. I thought that because I hadn't gone bankrupt, I hadn't had to mortgage the house, I hadn't lost my professional qualification, I hadn't this and I hadn't that and I hadn't been breathalyzed and all the things, that in this room, they told me, would happen if I went on drinking. They hadn't happened to me yet, you see. I thought that this was the unmanageability of my life. But my life is here. This is all there is of it. This is mind, body, and spirit. And all the rest were affairs, possessions, and relationships. And that was the mistake I made, because I was dying. My life had become unmanageable. I was lost, fragmented, shattered, emotionally, physically, and spiritually bankrupt. Lost. And I also saw that the affairs, possessions, and relationships, which had been my priority all my life, and the source of great pride, pass into other ownership if I die now, you know, they're only passing things, just as I am myself. But the important thing I saw then was myself, and I took the first step. Or as I heard someone say, I was overtaken by the first step, really. I qualified somehow or another, and I was overtaken by the first step of my own recovery. And immediately, I never quarreled with the word sanity. They didn't put me in a mental hospital for doing sane things, you see. So I wanted to be restored to sanity. I came to believe that, as you've been saying, a power greater than myself could do that for me. But it said could, and I was engaged by the word could, and from that day, I started to study this program. I was never any good at reading the instructions on anything. The instructions for every bit of equipment in my house was piled neatly with a rubber band around it. Nobody ever read it in a corner, you see. And so I spent my life compensating for the inexpertise, the inefficiency, which I could have dismissed if I'd read the instructions. You know, iron, fridges, telly, videos, wireless, everything worked at half for me because I wouldn't try to read the instructions. That day I understood. What I did to engage this power greater than myself on my own behalf was understand to the best of my ability. I speak only for myself. I can only talk in the light of my own understanding. That is my supreme limitation. I must make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God because I understood God. I understood this, that if I can have a personal understanding of something so vital, I can have a personal understanding of just about anything else. And I was away and running, you know. Had a sponsor, became sincere with the sponsor, got on with the fourth and fifth step, was heartbroken by the enormity of the sixth step, but understood that this is for my life. The amends I made, the being entirely ready is one day at a time for my life. It's not something to be over and done with. It's how I live. This I owe to AA, that I was newborn that first day of my sobriety into some understanding. And the greatest understanding I got was that at last in my life there was a constant factor. Everything in my life changed, and as the psychiatrist used to say, you can't adjust to change, that's your difficulty. And everything changes all the time, and I knew that I could. And so I have gone on studying. My home group is a big book study group. It was hard, because apart from being very ill emotionally, mentally, physically, and spiritually, I had no qualifying period in which I could get into the steps. It was like it was in the beginning for me. I got better by the practice of the steps within the limits of my understanding. I knew I couldn't rest on my laurels, that I must go on trying to understand better. And so I've gone on trying to study. I kept away from the first string by becoming a very devoted member to the tools of the program. I kept away from the drink one day at a time, and in time I learned to live my whole life within the confines of one day. And I don't want to feel somebody else's line, but if I don't get drunk today, I won't get drunk for the rest of my life. Because it's never tomorrow. Somebody very dear to me says, I never woke up and found it was tomorrow. I never woke up and found it was yesterday. It's always today, so I live today. I keep faith with the sponsor and for myself. All the integrity I've got is the integrity that exists in the relationship between my sponsor and myself. I use the telephone because I believe in the telephone. I'm the telephone liaison officer for my intergroup, and it's not an easy job because everlastingly people are trying to improve the telephone service, and I sometimes think we're trying to deploy forces we haven't got, you know, in improving the telephone service. So I speak to another alcoholic every day by my own effort, and I use the telephone. I study the program, and I live by this, leaving all the old ideas behind. And when they come back, unbidden and intrude, and I regret, I say, thank you. Now I know what I am. Now I know where I've been. And I'm not discouraged. I tell myself, do not be discouraged. Get on. Start all over again now. And I do. And I serve when an opportunity arises. And as our founder said, if no opportunity, I watch for when an opportunity arises sometimes, and I try to fill it. That's how I got sober, and that's how I stay sober. Plenty of meetings, a home group. I owe every good thing I have today to AA. The happy marriage, the good relationship with a healthy mother who's 80, who was broken by our drinking, family drinking. My son's happiness and healthy attitude to life. I owe these things to the fact that I'm from an AA committee. It's heartbreaking working on an AA committee. They don't see things the way I do. They don't go along with my good ideas. The vote goes against me. I'm the fellow that always votes against a good idea or gets voted against. But I've never resigned, you see, because I believe it's for my own good. I'm not on a committee to help them for 14 years. While I was drunk, they helped themselves quite well. I stayed there because it helped me to get on with my mother, to get on with my husband, to get on with my son, to get on with my stepdaughters, my next door neighbors. This is what service is about. It's made me part of the human fellowship, part of the universal, and this is such a big thing, you know. And I don't quite know how to say, but when it comes to having a good idea that gets voted out, or when they won't see things my way, or whatever, you know, or when I'm the only one that votes against a good idea, I have to work for the good idea that was voted, against which I voted. Because this, and now, I won't go to public, but this I owe to AA's future. Not quoting it properly, but to keep our fellowship united, not to be a disruptive, hostile, aggressive agitator, to keep our fellowship united, for upon it depends my very life and the lives of those to come. It's been a pleasure to be here, and thank you very much for asking.